Hello and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. This is your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. 1.1 million Americans are living with HIV infection. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there were an estimated 38,500 new HIV infections in 2015. This represents an 8% decline from nearly 42,000 in 2010. One of the reasons for this decline is diagnosis and access to treatment. However, 85% of people have received the diagnosis, but this leaves still 1 in 7 people with HIV who are unaware of their infection. This Wednesday, June 27th, is National HIV Testing Day. National HIV Testing Day was designated in 1995 as a day to unite with community partners, healthcare providers, public health agencies, and others to raise awareness about the importance of HIV testing and early diagnosis. Today, we've literally packed the studio with a slew of experienced experts to tell us more about the who, what, where, when, and how of screening for HIV infection. So welcome from my right to left, starting with Heather Davis, Executive Director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, henceforth and forever, at least for the next hour, to be known as the 4As. Terry Brammel, Clinical Specialist and Ryan White Program Director at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And Jessica Harville, HIV Program Coordinator with the Alaska Division of Public Health. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Great. So before we begin the discussion, I want to invite everyone to join into the conversation. Feel free to give us a call. If you're in the Anchorage area, the local number is 550-8433. You can also call in toll-free statewide, and that number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. If you're listening to the taped rebroadcast on Monday evening, we cannot take your questions on the air, but we can continue the discussion. We would welcome your questions or comments by email. So let's start with the question, why get tested for HIV?
I think one of the most important reasons is that you will not know if you are living with HIV unless you get a test. And we know that many people have not had a test, and it's recommended that all people 18 and older, correct me if I'm wrong on those numbers.
13 to 64.
Oh, is it 13 to 64? Get tested for HIV, at least have an baseline test. And then be tested more regularly depending on your lifestyle. But we know the importance of getting tested is to get into treatment as soon as possible, because if you get diagnosed, get on treatment, stay on treatment, we know that people can live a fairly normal life with the right care and treatment and medications.
So it's important to make the diagnosis to be able to have that treatment and be able to suppress the virus.
Correct.
Virally suppressed, I think, is the term that I recall. So let's dig a little deeper in that question of who should be tested. We mentioned persons age 13 to 64. You also mentioned some people should be tested more regularly. Who would that be?
That would be anybody who has multiple partners, condomless sex, shares injection drug equipment.
Men who have sex with men are at higher risk, or mm-hmm. high risk, like you said, heterosexuals.
Anybody who's had an STD, I don't know if I already said that. And okay. I would not cut it off at 64, even
Either
though that's
I.
the CDC recs. We have diagnosed people older than that. Life goes on after 60.
I think that's a very good point, Terry, and certainly there are data showing that sex does not end at age 65. So,
correct.
I'm only 60, but just checking. So let's talk about how the testing is done. Let's say I really don't like needles. So tell me more about what's involved in testing. Jessica, how about that question comes to you?
Yeah, so there are a couple different ways you can be tested for HIV. One of them is maybe in a non-clinical setting, like at 4A's office or with some of our community partners. We work with Identity, and we're at a lot of the community events around town, and we do what's called an HIV rapid test. And that can be done with a finger stick, or sometimes they'll have you swab your mouth to collect what's called oral fluid. And that's a 20-minute test that is looking for antibodies associated with HIV. Now, antibody tests are really easy. Like we said, we can do them without doing a blood draw. They can be done out and about in the community. But they are a little bit less sensitive than what your doctor might do in the doctor's office when he does a blood draw. Since they're looking for antibodies, or your body's response to HIV infection, it does have what's called a window period, which is a period of time where you have been infected with HIV and you are potentially infectious with HIV, but your body has not produced enough antibodies in response to that viral infection to be detected by this test technology. So these rapid tests can detect HIV beginning about 3 weeks after infection, and then on the far end we say 3 months. You know, 99.9% of people will have a positive or reactive rapid test within 3 months after infection. If you go into your doctor and do get a blood draw, we have some really fantastic sensitive, they're called fourth generation HIV tests that also look for antigens, so pieces of the virus itself. And those can begin detecting HIV virus as early as 10 to 12 days after infection.
Okay. So the rapid tests are antibody-based, so they're detecting your body's response to the virus itself. The blood tests, which are detecting probably the viral RNA.
Yep, there's a little P24.
Less than 2 weeks, okay, mm-hmm. and antigen. So let's say I'm exposed. Will I get sick?
So some people, so not everybody who's infected with HIV does experience an acute viral syndrome when they're seroconverting, or where they're becoming infected with HIV virus. Its symptoms may include fever, malaise, thrombocytopenia, which are little pinprick colored discolorations.
Low platelet count that can cause bleeding in the skin and a funny looking rash.
And a lot of strange rashes.
Okay.
Certainly those can be associated with a lot of other viral conditions. But if you have a concern that you've been exposed to HIV and experience those symptoms, it would definitely be a recommendation to go into your doctor, let them know about your concern so that they can order the correct tests and be tested for HIV. Terry might have more to add to that.
Yeah, it can look a lot like a bad flu or a mono infection.
I was thinking of mononucleosis.
But yeah, it can be all the way across the board. It could be meningitis. It could be hepatitis. So there's a lot of different manifestations. But the most common would be a flu-like illness or a mono-like illness,
okay,
sore throat, rash, fevers, that sort
and
of thing.
How long does that develop after the exposure?
Usually about a week to 10 days,
okay,
out to 3 weeks.
So it sounds like the blood test, the RNA test, is positive early and actually could be diagnostic during that illness.
Right. That's okay. Really when it plays the most important role.
Okay. So if, let's say I have the test, you mentioned the rapid test can come back in about 20 minutes. What about some of the other tests? Is there anything faster than that?
So depending on the test technologies out there, rapid tests, there's a new Insti test that can provide results in 1 minute. There's other types of tests that can provide results in 10 to 20 minutes. If your result is negative, basically what we know is that from birth until 3 months prior to you getting that rapid test, you were not infected with HIV. If the test is reactive, you do need additional testing. So they would draw your blood and send that to the laboratory to confirm your diagnosis. And they'd work really closely with anybody who gets a reactive rapid test to follow up and get those results and help link to services like Terry and Heather.
And of course, there's also the in-home tests that people can take, that people can go to the store and actually buy an HIV test and send it in to a third party and find out if they're infected that way. I don't know what the usage is of those tests. They're expensive to buy, so it's much cheaper to come to 4A's or someplace that offers free rapid testing or to go to your physician.
There's also the home test that you perform yourself.
Yeah,
that's the same technology as the oral.
So is this similar to a pregnancy test? I would test it at home myself and get a result.
It's got a lot of similarities to that.
Well, let's say I do one of those and it's positive. What do I do then?
Well, fortunately, the kits come with a lot of instructions and phone numbers to call. So it would put you in contact with somebody who could advise you. You would need to follow up with some sort of provider and get a confirmatory test to make sure that this is a real positive result.
Okay. Well, this is line one. Dr. Jay Butler here, and we're talking about HIV testing today. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 550-8433 or toll-free statewide at 888-353-5752. So we've talked a fair bit about the nature of the tests and what I might do with, a home test that turns out positive, but let's say I don't want to do that. Heather, I think you said it can be pretty pricey. So I'm going to come into 4A's or maybe over to the ANTHC and get tested. Where else can I go? Where do I go to get this test?
So CDC has a fantastic online resource. It is gettested.cdc.gov, and you enter your zip code, and it will let you know any location nearby that offers HIV testing. It'll let you know whether it's free or sliding scale. 4A's is always listed on that. ANTHC is listed. Also for folks in Anchorage, we work, the Anchorage Health Department has a clinic on 9th and L here in town. They offer HIV and STD testing on a sliding scale. You can always call them at 343-4623 to schedule an appointment and ask any questions.
And any medical provider would be able to do that test on request.
Okay. So that website, again, if you want to find out where to go get tested anywhere in Alaska, I suppose, is gettested.cdc.gov. And that is completely confidential. So we talked a little bit about what I should do if my test comes back positive. Let's talk about what's next after that. What's the prognosis? Question I used to get quite often when I was seeing patients who were not newly diagnosed is, Doc, am I going to die?
And in the old days, the answer was probably yes. But these days, with our great medications we have now, a person with well-controlled HIV who takes care of themselves, doesn't smoke, and lives a relatively healthy lifestyle, can live close to a normal lifespan, have children, just have a normal life.
Okay. Now, speaking of having children, and Jessica, you mentioned birth a little earlier. What are some of the special precautions that pregnant women who are infected with HIV can take? And also, how do we diagnose HIV infection in a newborn or rule it out? Because there are things we can do to prevent transmission mother to child.
Well, women getting prenatal care should have an HIV test with their prenatal labs. And generally, at least at our facility, that's repeated at 36 weeks because we can still intervene in protecting the baby. And with that information, if the woman is at risk, we could test the baby at birth, though that's not common unless there's a risk identified. And that would involve a blood draw for the baby because the baby will have the mother's antibodies. So you have to use different technology.
Okay.
What we do know is that if we have a woman who is living with HIV, who is pregnant, if she is taking her medications, if she has viral suppression, like you mentioned earlier, Dr. Butler, which means her medication is controlling her infection throughout her pregnancy, if the infant receives care upon delivery and for the first 18 months of life, that child is very, very likely will not be born with HIV and will not acquire HIV infection. It's actually been one of the I think, biggest accomplishments of HIV prevention, not only in the United States, but worldwide, is the prevention. And I think that we're now saying eliminating mother-to-child transmission of HIV. It's very effective and it's very successful.
It's very rare in this country to have a baby born with HIV, and usually that's in the case of late to prenatal care or no prenatal care or other issues.
Okay. So we've talked about viral suppression as part of treatment of a pregnant woman who's infected with HIV to prevent transmission to her child. Let's talk about the role of viral suppression in reducing transmission generally. We've spent most of our time talking about the benefit that you can gain from being tested, and if you are infected, knowing that and being able to get treatment. Are there other benefits of knowing your status and getting tested?
Well, from the public health perspective, that is the greatest benefit, is that we know that people that have been suppressed, had their virus suppressed for 6 months on medications, do not pass the virus to other people. So that's been part of the emphasis, both personal health and public health, to get people tested and on treatment. And CDC was so bold as to launch a campaign last fall saying that undetectable equals untransmissible.
Wow, that is
impressive. The U equals
impressive.
U campaign.
Right.
Yeah, they've done a big
right.
U equals
right.
U campaign.
And they've looked at a lot of data and find that it just is not transmitted when it's controlled.
That is quite remarkable. So while it's not yet a curable infection, it is a controllable infection. And
absolutely.
We're talking about control, not only that leads to prolongation of life and maybe even a nearly normal life expectancy, but also reduce or virtually elimination, you're telling me, of the risk of transmitting the infection to others.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is certainly good news. So when we think about screening and adequate treatment, being able to reduce the spread of HIV, it raises the question about what else can we do to protect ourselves from HIV?
I think the biggest thing is understanding that there is a risk there. A lot of people, I don't think, believe that HIV is still an issue out there. We don't hear a lot of talk about it. You know, people in their teens, young adults weren't around when the epidemic happened, so they don't have experience with it. And so we hear a lot that people think, you know, HIV isn't an issue, or I can take a pill, it will take care of it, it's no big deal. But of course it is a big deal, because, you know, you need to manage this disease for the rest of your life. So I think one of the important things is getting the prevention message out there to people of all ages that HIV is still out there, but there are steps you can take to prevent the disease, rather simple steps. But I think that that's one of the biggest thing is letting people know that it's still out there, and especially in Alaska, which has extremely high rates of STDs. So we know people aren't practicing safe sex with the high rates of sexually transmitted diseases we're seeing. So
there's a lot of steps. One with injection drug users, using clean needles, syringe exchange has been a proven public health strategy that works well. Of course, there's condoms and limiting the number of partners you have. And then there's PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, where somebody in a higher risk category for contracting HIV can take a medication every day that will protect them from acquiring HIV.
Okay. So that that PrEP is tenofovir and emtricitabine. Is that, let's say that's something that I want to use. I assume that's a prescription drug.
It's a prescription drug.
And do I take it only when I think I'm going to be exposed, or is it something that I need to take every day?
The recommendation is to take it every day. Okay. They've looked at some other strategies, but that's the most reliable.
Okay. How well is that drug tolerated?
Generally pretty well. If anybody has issues, maybe in the first month they might have some nausea, diarrhea, but that's fairly uncommon, and that can be treated. Once they get past that, most people don't feel a thing.
Okay. How effective is it?
It's about 90% effective.
Okay. Is it something that has also been used among self-injection drug users?
It has been.
There is a study out of Bangkok that showed that PrEP is effective amongst people who inject drugs. Although, as Terry has said, it's only as effective as someone adheres to their recommended medication regimen. So if someone, regardless of their risk factor, whether it's sexual or injection drug use, is not totally adhering to taking the pill every day, the less you take the medication or the less adherent you are, the less effective the medication is in preventing HIV transmission.
So it sounds like there's no one thing, but there's actually a number of things that people can do to reduce their risk of HIV.
Correct.
Okay.
There's even strategies that can be used after a potential HIV infection. We have what's called PEP, or post-exposure prophylaxis, which is a combination of HIV medications that has to be started within 72 hours of the HIV exposure, but really as soon as possible. It was mostly administered through emergency departments or urgent cares. If someone knows, for example, that their partner is HIV positive and they have a condom failure or some other concern that they have had a legitimate recent HIV exposure. But between PrEP and PEP and a lot of the other interventions, we have a lot of tools in our toolkit now to help prevent HIV infection.
All right. Well, we're going to go to a break. This is Line One, your health connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and we're talking about HIV testing. We'll be back with you in a minute.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. With me here in the studio is Heather Davis, Executive Director of the 4As, Terry Brammel from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. She's a clinical specialist, and Ryan White, Program Director, and Jessica Harville, HIV Prevention Coordinator at the Alaska Division of Public Health. And in honor of July 27th being the National HIV Testing Day, we are talking about HIV testing as well as an update on what's going on in the world of HIV infection. And I have to say, one of the updates that just occurred to me is we usually don't say HIV/AIDS anymore because thanks to testing and some of the things we've been talking about over the last 20 minutes, we don't see AIDS as much as we used to, although I'll put in the caveat that we see it more often than we would like to. And that's usually because of delayed diagnosis. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about how HIV is spread and what the current epidemiology is. What are the trends? We started by talking about how there are fewer infections now than there were 5 to 10 years ago. But let's start a little bit talking about how is HIV infected. If we think back to the 80s, there was all kinds of fears that riding on a bus or going to a restaurant could be a way that you could get HIV.
Sure. So HIV actually is pretty hard to get and transmit. There are certain body fluids that can contain the HIV virus, semen and preseminal fluid, vaginal and rectal fluids, breast milk if a woman is living with HIV and pregnant or nursing, and blood, of course. So the primary modes of transmission are associated with those fluids. So sex, particularly anal or vaginal sex, regardless of what your gender or gender identity is, and direct blood contact, like you might see using and sharing needles or works if through injection drug behaviors.
Okay. So question from email here. If a woman is infected with HIV and she's virally suppressed, can she breastfeed?
We still do not recommend it in this country because we don't have enough data to say that it's safe. In other countries, developing nations, where they don't have clean water and access to safe formula, then the lesser of two evils is to breastfeed. But there is about a 12% risk of passing it on to the baby through breastfeeding. So.
Okay. And as we've talked about body fluids that can spread HIV, certainly semen is one of those. So another question from email is, can a man with HIV safely father a child?
If he is on medication and has achieved durable viral suppression, then yes, absolutely, he can safely father a child.
And our strategy to be extra safe, because we really don't want to risk babies getting HIV, is to put, if it was a HIV-positive man, virally suppressed, during the time that they're trying to conceive, we would recommend that the woman be on PrEP, and vice versa if it's a HIV positive woman trying to get pregnant with an HIV negative man. That would just be an extra level of insurance to keep them safe. And we have used that strategy, and it works great.
Okay, so in the instance where the potential father or father-to-be is virally suppressed, the mother is uninfected, is there a role for pre-exposure prophylaxis using tenofovir and tricitabine?
I would recommend that just as a, you know, double insurance to protect the mom.
Okay, very good. So let's talk about the trends in HIV infection. Jessica, I'm looking to you on this one. We've talked about how the number of infections has declined. Has the characteristics of who's at risk changed?
Sure. So Alaska continues to be actually a very low incidence jurisdiction for HIV, which means compared to other states, our rates of HIV infection are relatively low. Since we first began reporting and tracking HIV cases in 1982. Through the end of last year, we've had 1,832 cases of HIV ever reported in the state. And that would include folks who are both newly diagnosed here in Alaska and folks who were previously diagnosed out of state and have moved here to Alaska. In 2017, last year, we had 29 new cases of HIV diagnosed in the state. And that's pretty on par. We usually see 30 to 40 new cases of HIV each year. You know, we see it in all age ranges up here. Last year we had cases in folks from age 19 all the way through age 63. I think what Terry mentioned earlier about continuing to include routine HIV screening for folks throughout their lifetime is particularly important up here in Alaska, and particularly in our more rural areas, where someone might not have had an HIV test before. About 18 of our cases last year were, 21 of our cases last year were amongst men, and 18 were gay and bisexual men who have sex with men. That's a term we use because we don't want to label someone's sexual preferences or sexual orientation, but when we've talked to them about what their potential risks for HIV were, it was sex with another man. You know, I think the big things to pull out from our data up here are that we are continuing to see new cases of HIV, particularly amongst our young gay and bisexual men We continue to see cases in heterosexuals also. You know, even though 18 of our 29 cases were amongst men who have sex with men, that means we had almost 40% in people who were primarily at heterosexual risk for HIV. That is not insignificant. And we need to continue to be screening people across their lifetime.
Okay. Terry, you mentioned that we have very high rates of chlamydia infection. We're experiencing epidemics of gonorrhea and syphilis right now. And you also mentioned that other sexually transmitted diseases can be a marker for risk of HIV. Yet we also have lower rates of HIV than many other states. This strikes me as... But for the grace of God, there go us. What do you have any explanation for what's going on there?
I don't think we have a really clear explanation other than we've been lucky. But I think it has to do with social networks. And there may be a lot of other STIs being passed in a social network, but HIV has not been introduced into that network at a level that causes explosion. But that can happen at any time. I always liken it to Russian roulette, you know. It's like, yeah, you're safe until you're not. So it's been surprising that we have not had a major epidemic. But what we do find often, especially in rural areas, is that when a new diagnosis is identified and partner investigation happens, that there's another cluster behind that of people, some of who have been infected for a very long time, that have just never been tested. So in that social network, it's, you know, been spreading. But because of the nature of the state and some of the isolation, the mixing is not quite what it might be in an urban setting.
Well, the term social network might make us think of Facebook because of the movie, but there are other social networks.
Network,
so
yeah.
Is there a role for some of the apps that are available to that are specifically designed for meeting sexual partners?
Yeah. They're definitely a risk factor, yeah. People that are meeting people using those apps. But I'll let Jessica address how the state addresses prevention.
Well, first, I would call them venues more than risk factors. You know, since time immemorial, people have been finding ways to hook up with other people if they really want to. And that just right now, it is, the venue is more based on the cloud or so mobile-based. I think that the takeaway message needs to be, no matter how you're meeting your sexual partners, whether it's going to the bar or using a mobile app like Tinder or Grindr, you need to be using some of those HIV risk reduction strategies to protect yourself from getting STDs and potentially HIV, using a condom, getting tested regularly, reducing your number of partners if that's appropriate for you, talking to your medical provider about getting on PrEP for pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. You know, it all gets down to the behaviors, not necessarily the venue.
And talking to your partner as well, you know, having those discussions up front.
Yeah. Very good. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. With me are Heather Davis, Terry Brammel, and Jessica Harville. Join the conversation. If you're in the Anchorage area, our local number is 550-8433, or you can call in toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. And we've already received a couple of emails. Keep them coming. We're at line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're listening in the evening, we can't take calls, but we'd be happy to take your email and hopefully follow up with you off the air. So we've talked about rural clusters, and I can't help but think about what happened in southern Indiana not so very long ago when a cluster was identified initially among women who were getting their prenatal screening. Their partner follow-ups led to a couple dozen cases that were identified. And before the next 6 months was out, over 180 cases of acute HIV infection were identified in this county, with a population not that much different than, say, Dutch Harbor or Wasilla. Certainly a terrifying situation. Now, it's thought that while the virus may have been smoldering in the county primarily through sexual transmission, maybe some needle transmission, it was the sharing of syringes and needles during self-injection drug use that made the epidemic explode. So as we talk about prevention measures, I wanted to have a chance to talk about syringe and needle service programs. Heather, I know that's something that's in the 4A's portfolio. You want to tell us more about that?
Sure. 4A's has been running a syringe access program since 2007. And of course, when the program started, the epidemic was nowhere near the size it is now. And we've seen it grow rapidly over the last 11 years. But we also know that providing people with clean syringes is a really effective method to protect against the transmission of HIV, hepatitis C, other infectious diseases. Contrary to many public's thought, it does not increase the use of opioids or increase injection drug use. It's actually a CDC recommendation program to help prevent the spread of diseases.
Okay, so there's no evidence that if I see a syringe and needle, I'm going to automatically think, I think I need to try heroin today.
Absolutely not. In fact, more people who take part in syringe access programs have a greater likelihood that they will get the services they need to hopefully help them get through this time in their life and give them other resources to go to. So it actually helps to decrease usage.
Okay. Including testing for HIV, returning to our theme for the day.
Yeah, so, I mean, we try to really encourage and make sure our injection drug users have regular HIV tests as well as hepatitis C. It's actually a population in which we see much more hepatitis C than HIV in the state. But, yes, we really track people and encourage them to keep up on their tests.
Okay. So let's say I have a loved one who is a self-injection drug user. They're struggling with addiction. They're not yet ready to seek the different ways, the paths to recovery. What can I do?
You can come and talk to us, and we can give you the tools necessary to work with that person who you're concerned about. Sometimes people don't feel comfortable coming initially, but we have parents or partners or friends who often come to the 4A's concerned about somebody that they know and asking for information and getting maybe the supplies, the syringes, and the works for them or the resources available for them. So anybody's welcome to come, whether they're an injection drug user or not. And, of course, we also provide the Narcan kits for overdose. So many times we have family members who actually come and get the Narcan kits. They aren't a utilizer, but they know somebody who's at risk, so they'll get them.
Okay. And many of us do know someone at risk these days. So as we've talked about epidemiology and prevention, there was something caught my eye about a month or two ago. The new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Robert Redfield, a longtime researcher in the area of AIDS and HIV, he stated that he hopes to eliminate HIV transmission in the United States. Boy, elimination. That's sort of just short of eradication. We have achieved that with smallpox, also with the disease Rinderpest, which is not a human disease, but a disease that affects cattle. Elimination, that's a tall order. Is that feasible?
Well, we have the tools available, but the will is slow to follow. And then, you know, we always have some challenging people with challenging life issues that are the hardest to reach and to do prevention with. But we essentially do have the tools available. And some major cities like New York and San Francisco have getting to zero campaigns, and they have really, really, really cut down their rate of new infections.
And I believe the entire state of Washington has also set that goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, well, very good. So let's go to a break. This is Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. We're talking about HIV screening and prevention. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and here with me in the studio is Heather Davis of the 4As, Terry Brammel, HIV Clinical Specialist, and Ryan White, Program Director at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Jessica Harville, HIV Prevention Coordinator at the Alaska Division of Public Health. So, let's talk a bit more about some of those challenging life issues. HIV used to be almost a death sentence, and that's not the case anymore. There are many life issues to be dealt with once the diagnosis is made and someone is in good quality care. Some of those other challenges are actually health challenges. So what are some of the ways that someone who has HIV and is virally suppressed, we've talked about preventing spread of infection, but what else do they need to think about to stay healthy?
General healthy lifestyle choices, by far the biggest one is avoiding tobacco use. That will take many more years off your life than the HIV infection will. 8 to 12 years, I think, is the estimate. So that is really a big modifiable risk factor, as well as, you know, treating cardiovascular risk disease and diabetes and all the other things, the diseases of aging that may be a little earlier and a little more pronounced in HIV infection. And I just ran across, I think yesterday, there's actually a specialty now in geriatric HIV care, because HIV care has really become a disease of aging. Now that we can control the virus, we have all the primary care, primary health care issues to deal with. That is what people are dying of, is cardiovascular disease and cancer and all the other things that affect the rest of us.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's also important to talk about the people who have difficulty staying on the medication regimen. You know, we have a lot of homelessness, poverty, and a lot of those make it difficult for clients to stay on their medication because their biggest issue at the moment is trying to find food, trying to find housing. So it's something we also have to be really aware of, people living with HIV, is that it's not that easy to get everybody virally suppressed, that a lot of people are facing multiple challenging issues in their life, mental health and others, substance abuse disorders. So, and really working closely with that population to try to get them under care and treatment as well.
And that's something we've really been working at the State Health Department. We actually, in 2012, received funds from the Centers for Disease Control to implement a pilot project on what we called linkage to care. And it really is a little bit of additional supportive services for folks who are newly diagnosed with HIV, to help talk to them through the process of meeting with an HIV care provider, meeting with supportive social services like you might find at 4As, and any other resource that might help them achieve retention in HIV care and achieve viral suppression. That we've expanded the program. We work also with folks who were previously diagnosed with HIV, but maybe haven't been seeing a healthcare provider for their HIV infection. We work with them sometimes with referrals from healthcare providers or from 4As, see about providing them with the services and resources they need to get back into care.
I remember when Magic Johnson was diagnosed and announced that he had HIV. That was 1991. And at the time, many people, including myself, assumed that his life, not only his life with the Lakers was over, that his life was over. But here we are 27 years later, and Magic Johnson is active, and he turns 60 next year. So the life expectancy for people with well-controlled HIV and who don't smoke is really pretty much on par with that of the general population. But the key there is to get to care, and the first step to get to care is to be tested and diagnosed. So if you would like to join the conversation, this is Line 1, your health connection. We're talking about HIV testing and HIV care. If you're in the Anchorage area, the local number is 550-8433. You can also call in toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752, or send us an email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Terry, as we think about the ways to get into care, and I look at your professional job title, the Ryan White Program is one that is oftentimes cited as one of the mechanisms that have really provided care for people with HIV infection. First of all, who is Ryan White, and what is the Ryan White Program?
Ryan White was a young 14-year-old, I believe, when he was diagnosed hemophiliac, who got HIV before we even knew how to test for it or what was going on, and was basically, through stigma, run out of his community through fear. They didn't want him in the school. And he eventually died. We did not have good treatments back then. And his mother became a real crusader. And shortly after he died, the Ryan White Care Act was implemented by Congress to provide funding for care and treatment of people with HIV. And there are multiple different programs under the Ryan White funding stream. One thing I can say, when you look at the data on how well people do with HIV, Ryan White clinics perform much higher than the average because of the wraparound services like case management and other things.
So that gets back to that issue you raised earlier. For some people with HIV, there's challenging life situations that the Ryan White Program can also help address.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Ryan White had hemophilia, and people who are of a certain age may remember that we oftentimes thought about blood transfusion as a way that the infection was acquired. Hemophilia is treated with concentrations of factor VIII, so a single factor VIII infusion for a hemophiliac may have the blood from literally dozens, if not hundreds, of people. Is the blood supply safe from HIV today?
Yes, the blood supply is very safe since 1985, I believe, when we first started testing, and the testing has gotten more and more sensitive, that it's just not considered a risk factor. It's not impossible to have somebody slip through the very tiny window. But
it is improbable.
It's highly improbable. And when somebody goes to donate blood, not only do they get tested, but they get screened for risk factors that may identify people that could potentially be in that very short 2-week window where their tests may not show infection.
Okay. So we have a caller. I'd like to welcome Kay. Welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Thank you. I'm calling about what would be called unintended consequences from your programs. I understand the good that you're doing with having the needle exchange programs and so on. But if someone lives near one of those places, those centers for needle exchange, we are having nightly car break-ins, vandalism in the yard, things broken apart, property crimes. I'm interested in how your agencies are working with police to protect the people who are living in these neighborhoods that have become the draws for active addicts who are looking for money.
So, Heather, maybe you could take a crack at that, since looking around the room, I think yours is the agency that runs a syringe and needle exchange program.
Exactly. I think we all know that, crime is up in Anchorage as a whole. We don't know that it's all in due to injection drug users in our community. So I think it's really hard to point the finger that it's the drug injecting population. I do know that syringe exchanges keep needles off our streets, keep our population and our kids safer. Last year, we pulled, I think, close to 800,000 needles off the streets of Anchorage. It's really important to remember that, that if the syringe access program wasn't there, these syringes would be littering our streets. But I think crime is an issue here in Anchorage, but I think there are a lot of things driving it, poverty, homelessness, the opioid epidemic, but I don't think you can point the finger at just one thing.
And it's true across the state, even in the very rural villages, they've seen a huge uptick in crime attributed to drug use. And I know my second home is in Homer, and the crime has just really skyrocketed there as well. It's not what it used to be.
Okay. So in terms of the issue of finding needles around town, as we talk about syringe and needle exchange, sometimes called service programs, you're using the term exchange in part because needles are actually coming back into you.
Correct.
And you're disposing of them.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that question, Kay. We've talked a lot about viral suppression and how the modern antiretrovirals are very effective, very safe, very well tolerated. Are there misperceptions about treatment? Are there ineffective treatments that you know of that are being promoted? Or maybe treatment is so mainstream now that doesn't happen.
No. I mean, the main thing I see is people who just don't believe that, you know, the medications are safe and that they control the virus, that there are.
And I think with any disease, you have folks who are very hopeful about alternative remedies that maybe include, I think I heard someone talk about something that involved Chagas. And when I worked in sub-Saharan Africa, there were a lot of rumors about, you know, being able to cure HIV infection by performing acts or eating certain foods. And I think those exist for kind of rumors exist for all diseases and conditions, and unfortunately, they're just not effective in keeping someone healthy and preventing them from transmitting disease. And it's why it's just so important to talk to a healthcare provider like Terry about what the best treatment for you is. And if you have concerns about what your HIV treatment is or any symptoms you've been encountering, talk to your provider about it and let them know, and they can work with you to find a better treatment option for you.
Okay. What are some of the common misperceptions you hear? We've talked about maybe ideas about treatment that aren't effective, but sort of at the broader level, when you know, there's concern about how to prevent transmission, or maybe ideas that are not beneficial to keep the public safe from HIV. What are some of the misperceptions that are out there that you'd like to address?
I don't hear quite as many as I used to, like the mosquitoes or the toilet seat or shaking hands. Those things you really don't hear like you used to hear. You know, people would think that a mosquito could transmit it, or if you shook someone's hand. So I don't believe we really hear a lot of that anymore.
But there's still a lot of thought that this is just a gay disease.
That's very true.
That you can tell somebody has HIV by looking at them, that, you know, you don't associate with those kind of people, therefore you're safe. I've heard young men say that I only have had sex with other young people, and somehow that would be protective.
I've also heard if you're on top, you can't get HIV infection, and that is also not correct.
Gravity keeps the virus down.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. So, well, mosquitoes have a lot of things that they do, not spreading HIV. But when we think about the global infectious disease threats, I mean, Ebola grabs the headline, also not spread by mosquitoes that we know of. But a mosquito-borne disease, malaria, together with other diseases like tuberculosis and also HIV, together kill nearly 4 million people in the world each year. Jessica, what's happening with the HIV pandemic globally? There's been a lot of good news in North America. Is it as good when we look at the global picture?
Yeah, I'm actually, it's looking good globally also. I think particularly over the last 5 years, there have been fantastic strides around the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, to decrease new infections of HIV, to help provide people who are living with HIV with access to medical care that's keeping them healthier and preventing them from transmitting the virus. There are countries that are still struggling a little bit. I think we've seen quite a bit of discussion about Russia's HIV infection rates that are very closely associated with injection drug use and how they're climbing. But overall, we're doing great. And like I mentioned earlier, one of the big achievements of HIV prevention around the world is eliminating mother-to-child transmission and the whole concept of preventing infants born to HIV-infected mothers from being HIV-infected themselves. You know, we've done a fantastic job of really reducing perinatal transmission of HIV.
And as we've seen the rollout of antiretroviral medications across the world, we've seen a subsequent drop in new infections. I think I saw a number the other day that 21 million people in the world are now on antiretroviral therapy, which is a huge improvement over what it used to be.
Was that 21 million?
21 million.
That's remarkable. Mm-hmm.
And that the regimen is so simple now, too, has made it much easier. You know, it used to be many, many, many pills that you had to take, and now people can often take one or two pills a day, and that's a huge change for medication adherence.
Yes, when HIV first came out, I remember alarms going off in the hospital to make the rounds with the AZT again because the dosing interval was so short at that time. And once-a-day dosing is available now. The medications are very well tolerated as well. So to wrap up, we're in the last 30 seconds or so. What's the one thing you hope people will take away from this? And I'm going to take that to Terry.
I would say get tested and talk about HIV. Let's decrease the stigma so that people aren't afraid or ashamed to get tested or to get treated. It's all part of helping curtail this disease.
Okay. Yeah, I would absolutely agree, you know, especially on HIV testing day. It's a great day to get people out there. And like Terry said, don't be afraid to talk to people about your if you think you have a concern.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Heather Davis, Terry Brammel, Jessica Harville, for discussing HIV testing in honor of HIV Testing Day coming up June 27th. Thank you very much to listeners who joined us today. Next week, Prentice Pemberton will be back to discuss with his guest, Dr. Stephen Hayes, acceptance and commitment therapy. Dave Waldron produced today's program and was also sound engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.